and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that reaches across the generations in search of stories. Today's guest is Sophie Pavel, zoologist, science communicator, comms coordinator for the Beaver Trust, journalist, and soon-to-be-published author with her book, Forget Me Not, being published by Bloomsbury. Hello, and welcome to the show, Sophie.
Hello, Kerry. Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Yeah, this is great. I don't know what it's like with you, but the sun is shining here. We still had a frost this morning, but I'm invigorated by the nature around me.
Spring is here.
It is.
Yeah, spring is here.
So where are you in the world? You're in a nice part of the world, aren't you?
I am, yeah. So I'm in East Devon. I'm in a small village that's near the coast, near the Jurassic coast. And yeah, not too far outside of Exeter, but lots of nice places on my doorstep, which has definitely been a bit of a lifeline.
How did your love of wildlife begin? Is it because you were brought up where you now live?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in other interviews and stuff, I've sort of said that it's never really been, it's not a great story, really. It's not a, I never had a eureka moment of awakening where I was sort of like, yes, this is what I need to do and I'm really interested in it and this is what I'm good at. I think it was more just a byproduct of my brother and I were born in the States, actually. My dad's American, my parents were both in the Navy, and so they were naturally very outdoorsy and adventurous, and I think wanted us to have a childhood that was filled with all sorts of wholesome activity. And when we moved from the States, we moved down in the village not too far from us, actually, just right on the river, and we grew up with the River X as our doorstep, and then we've got Dartmoor nearby and the coast. And I think all of our holidays were local. We didn't go abroad until we were in our early teens, I think, because our parents were very much promoting the message that I think my brother and I have still retained in a way and adopted ourselves, in terms of why give other countries your time when we have such an amazing island that we live on that we need to explore first? You know, where else in the world can you be, in the city or the mountains or on smaller islands and archipelagos, all within pretty much a day of each other? It's so unique in that sense. And I think it's massively overlooked. And so I think just with the outdoors being my childhood and very kind of innocent, wholesome activities percolating throughout the years of growing up, I think that it just sort of became part of me. And so I've been trying to craft a job that keeps me doing those sorts of things.
but isn't that kind of a eureka moment, that actually you realise you've been surrounded by this world for all your life and you've taken part in it, that actually you then wanted to move on to make it vocational, to do something for the environment?
Yeah, I suppose so. I never really thought about it that way. I guess it is an awakening in the sense that I have recognised in the last couple of years that, you know, there's so much chatter and dialogue about mental health and contentment and things like that. And I think the last year has really highlighted that in many ways. And I think I've realised I'm at my most content and happy and settled when I'm regularly outside. And I don't, this isn't anything revolutionary. It's I think, human nature to feel at peace when you're outside a lot in nature. And I guess I'm lucky that I found a vocation that suits my skill set, which has taken me a while to recognize, and then just trying to merge it all together.
Yeah.
A work in progress.
Hey, we're all works in progress all the way through, I think, from what I can see. And I know what you mean. There's something about nature that once you're in it does something to you. I had my first day out on location, as I say, yesterday on the River Welland, or on the tributaries. And it's the first time I've been able to record and work with people. I mean, it was kind of a beautiful shock to the system that I was actually there talking about nature with people who are interested, talking about issues of rivers and waterways. But what I take away from it all is that I started off freezing cold at 8 o'clock standing in a river and then went through the cycle of the day, and between 2 and 4 ended up, you know, bathed in sunlight, and it was wonderful. And then night again at about 7:30, being more frozen than I was in the morning because you've been heated up, and then suddenly it just dropped, and went through that cycle and had to get home and have a hot shower because I was that cold. But everything was fantastic, that cycle of the day, being out there, watching, never mind seasons changing, watching the hours change. And it was just beautiful. It was a great, great day. And that's kind of, I think, why we do these things, because we want to be with nature. We want to tell people about it because it's a fantastic experience. And on the whole, other than parking in some places, it's free.
Yeah, oh, totally. And I think that there are so many different ways that you can communicate the outdoors. I think there's a dangerous narrative that I've become aware of, I guess, in terms of, you know, I'm very lucky to live where I live. I didn't choose to live here. It's where my parents chose for us to live. So it's very much just fortuitous that that's been the case. But obviously, so many people live in urban centres and in areas where they don't have green space. And I think I've often felt that I need to be a little bit careful that I don't promote the outdoors as some kind of privileged experience that, you know, you're just very lucky to be able to enjoy. Everybody should be able to enjoy it no matter what. And it is free. And you don't need like the best outdoor kit or loads of money to be able to have a great time. But I think that the conservation world can do a lot more, I think, and it's very high up on the agenda for a lot of NGOs and organisations to really tackle how can we make nature more accessible in every sense of the word so that everybody can realise the joy that can be found in the most simplest of things, of watching a sunset, watching a bee, watching a bird build its nest, those sorts of things.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And you're absolutely right. It's making sure that it doesn't come along as something of privilege. It really should just be there. And I think everyone needs to engage with different communities, different people from different social strata across the board, and just try and find a way to make people go, it's okay, it's all right, it's for everyone.
Yeah.
The other thing that also drives me nuts is the more that I've worked in conservation and in nature is how few jobs there are in the natural world, especially for younger people who may be fresh out of college or finishing school. And these people who are desperately keen to work within the environment, there's nowhere to go because I guess there's not enough money in it for people to invest. How frustrating is that? And how can we help younger people get into this kind of work?
Oh, Kerry, this is a thing that is really, really close to my heart because I have been in that position so many times. And I think it's just crazy how little conservation, I mean, maybe it's changed. I haven't been at school for the last, I don't know how many, quite a few years. But I went to a science specialist school and not once did they ever promote conservation as a viable career option. It was always engineering, maths, medicine, veterinary medicine, dentistry, things like that, big vocational, law, those sorts of things. And I knew that I didn't want to do that. I'm not very good at maths. And so lots of those career paths intimidated me. And so my parents just encouraged me to do what I enjoyed, which was zoology. But then zoology is an amazing degree, but you're kind of left with this very broad, vague knowledge and lots and lots and lots of different things, but you don't know how to apply it. You know, it's impossible to learn about the natural world in 3 years and then go out and do a job in it. So then that's when the master's really helped me because it kind of helped fine tune my knowledge and figure out where I wanted to go and sort of give me a bit more confidence. But then after that master's, so I left with a distinction and I had a first class undergraduate degree in a relevant area. And I spent the next 2 years failing to get a job in the sector, any job. I applied for very low level assistant education roles at conservation organisations, comms roles, admin stuff. Always got to, you know, relatively far through the job selection, but then never quite got it. And it was always the classic of you haven't got quite enough experience, but then even getting work experience was really difficult. I got tons of work experience, but nothing, you know, it's all really valuable, but I sort of was getting a few gigs here and there doing freelance writing and making good connections with different organisations in the sector. But what I really, really wanted was just to be part of a team because I was still really young. I was in 21, 22. I felt like I had so much to learn. It was all really intimidating. I knew that the environmental sector was growing and that comms was getting really important and things like Blue Planet 2 was coming out, social media was kicking off. So I knew that something was bubbling, but I just didn't quite know how to tap into it. And so I was really lucky to get my first job nearly exactly a year ago now with Beaver Trust, where I'm now comms coordinator. And that has just made the world of difference to my confidence. And there's so much value, I think, to be said for feeling like you're making a difference in your job and that you're a very working cog in part of a larger team. And so that's been really, really beneficial. But I really feel for lots of young people, because I get messages all the time on my social media from people saying, how do I get a job here? How did you start all of this? And the main things that I recommend is doing things like volunteering for your local wildlife trust, becoming a member of your local wildlife trust, being good at networking, things like that. But all this sort of advice, but then you never know whether it's going to turn into anything. And yet at the same time, we're hearing how we need more people than ever to go into science communication and conservation and all of this. But at the end of the day, we need to pay our bills and we need jobs. And so it's a really, really tricky one.
Yeah. And it's something I found when I was doing one of the book tours for our books, that people would say, it's so inspiring talking about this and hearing about these things, but we have no point of entry. And that's the difficult thing. And you hit on several things. Most people just want to be part of a team that's doing an overall good job for something. And also the word volunteer, which I think in a weirdest kind of way is one of the most disgusting words in the conservation dictionary these days, because basically what it means is there's work to be done, we're not paying for it, the government's not paying for it, big companies aren't paying for it, but you'll do it because you care about the world around you.
Oh, totally. And, you know, volunteers are so vital to conservation in many ways, but I totally agree. I think I did so much work for free leading up to it, and there was just an expectation that I was young. Yes, I had 2 degrees, but I didn't have enough experience. And so, you know, I had to be satisfied with doing a lot of good work for free. And there's still a slight expectation there, which really does bother me.
You mean an expectation from the people you're volunteering for?
Or an expectation for me to do work that I wouldn't be doing had I not spent lots of money at university and getting my degrees and things, that I wouldn't be in a position to be sought for work had I not done that. And so then to be expected to do good work for free, that you've essentially worked really hard to get to that point, is a bit of a kick in the teeth at times. But then you're sort of like, no, be grateful for the work, be grateful for all of this. But it's really challenging for young people out there at the moment. And I really feel for them in terms of so many people have such a burning desire to do something about it. And we're so quick to encourage people to take action and take action for the climate and get out in your local community, but it's not going to pay the bills unless there's an actual role there. And I was working 3 retail jobs at one time, just trying to stay afloat whilst also trying to get into conservation.
It's tough. And also, you think about it, you're somebody who's had this great academic career, you know, and you've gone and learnt this and you've got your master's and et cetera, et cetera. Imagine the people who haven't even been able to do that. There's no chance for them to do anything. I just find something so inherently wrong that we have to rely on volunteers, and then we have to rely on usually private individuals' love of something to set up some of these NGOs and trusts and things, which I suppose brings us neatly to the Beaver Trust, where you work. How did you get involved with the Beaver Trust?
So I was actually approached by James Wallace, who's the chief executive, and he asked me, he said, I'm leading this new charity called Beaver Trust, which is hoping to restore rivers and wildlife with beavers across Britain, and we're looking to expand our board of trustees. And he said, we'd love to chat to you about whether or not you'd like to become a trustee. He's one of the most forward-thinking people I've ever met in conservation, in terms of he immediately recognised that boards of trustees are often full of older people who have had very impressive careers and, you know, have a lot of experience and wisdom to share. But then also young people have lots to share as well and are often very clued up in what's going on at the moment and have different perspectives that I think are equally valuable. And so he wanted to lower the age group of his trustee board. And so I had a couple of chats, really liked them. They were very much in startup mode at that time. So there were only sort of 3 or 4 people for the whole charity at that time. And then they offered me the trustee role. And I sort of said, can I just be honest with you? I've been trying really hard and I've applied for about 15 jobs in the conservation sector in comms and not got any of them. And I said, I'm really at my wit's end here and I can't take another voluntary role that's going to take up time that I will feel conflicted over because I'll really want to do it, but it's not going to pay the bills and it's not going to allow me to leave home and start my life. And he sort of said, well, actually, as it happens, we have a bit of budget at the moment to help the comms team and we need someone to help build our comms over the next year. Are you interested? I was like, absolutely, yes. And then I started on the Monday. So I think this is on like the Thursday or Friday. And then because they were startup, they were very much, they were in a position to be able to just sort of cherry pick people and start them straight away. There wasn't a formal HR process at that time, but there is now. So I started, was very much sort of working month to month in terms of, you know, all NGOs really have suffered during coronavirus with their budgets and funding. And so it was very much working on a monthly sort of, have we got enough money to pay for another month? And then it was extended till August and then Christmas. And then the charity has just blossomed over the last year. And we've got a bigger team now and we're working really hard at getting beavers back and legally recognised as native across England and all sorts of projects and things. So yeah, it's been a whirlwind of a year, but amazing.
What was it about beavers that you think is so important for bringing back? Perhaps you could explain a little bit about beavers, because a lot of people don't realise they used to be a native species here.
Yeah, exactly. So beavers, gosh, I mean, they were a part of our landscape for thousands of years, working, co-evolving with wetlands and riparian, so river ecosystems, co-evolving with the river wildlife that we know, like salmon and trout and water voles and otters and aspen and willow, all these trees and flora and fauna that are so special to British river landscapes. But then we hunted them to extinction about 400 years ago, and we were hunting them for their very luxurious pelts, so their fur, and then they have this secretion called castoreum, which we used in medicines and perfumes and things like that, and is still used around the world today, which I find a bit shocking. And so then in that 400 years where we didn't have beavers, of course, we had the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the world wars. So the land that beavers once roamed freely in has changed beyond recognition. And so all of a sudden, we're now having the second largest rodent in the world, which is the Eurasian beaver, back in our rivers. And we don't quite know how to deal with it, because this is an animal that exerts an incredible influence on its environment and really makes itself known. So they feed on vegetation only. They don't feed on fish, which is common belief, thanks to C.S. Lewis and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver eating fish. They do not eat fish. They fell trees, they build their dams, they flood wetlands. And so, of course, as our lives have become very busy and cluttered, especially down here in England in the south, beavers are struggling to fit in. And so that's where we have the conflict. And so Beaver Trust is working really hard to not only get beavers back and help restore the health of our rivers, which are not very healthy at all on the whole, but also to come up with a management framework so that we can deal with beavers better, because they are an incredible ally in terms of helping us mitigate the effects of climate change, such as drought and flooding. They can slow the peak flow of water during a flood, so they can help alleviate flooding impact on communities who suffer from flooding. They store millions of gallons of water in their wetlands all year round. So in periods of drought, like we're entering into at the moment, you can siphon off water from a beaver pond and put it out into your fields, on your crops. And the beaver wetland stores up to 3 times as much carbon as a non-beaver wetland. And they increase biodiversity massively. Wherever there is water, the wildlife will come, and beavers ensure there's plenty of water about. So, I mean, just they are an absolutely incredible animal and totally unique in terms of the influence that they exert on an environment for their size and for their numbers. And so it's just been fascinating to, they're a real teacher of ecology. And so it's been amazing to, from a zoological perspective, but then also just as like a curious citizen, to learn a bit about what this incredible rodent can do.
So can you remember your first engagement with a beaver and how you felt? Because there is something always, I think, magical about that first encounter.
Oh, totally. It was actually last year, weirdly enough. So much happened last year. I live quite near the River Otter, which is where the first official wild population of English beavers live. And it's a beautiful stretch of river, and it goes right down to the Jurassic coast. I've known that there were beavers there for ages, for about 6 years. And it was a beautiful summer's evening, and I was there with my best friend, and we were on a walk. And there were lots of sightings of the mum beaver and her kits. It's sort of, I think it was June last year. So kits come out about May, June. They stay in their lodge for 6 weeks, and then they sort of have a glorious emergence, and then they're fairly confident around people, especially down there. So it's really easy to go watch them. But obviously you have to keep your distance. And we were about to turn around. It was sort of 7:30, and I was like, oh, not going to see them. I'm not going to see them. Okay, it's fine. And then a guy who I bumped into down there was like, oh, beaver, beaver, get down. It's like sort of very dramatic, kind of like in a military exercise, you know, sort of dropping to the floor and hushed tones. And there was the mum beaver who was enormous. She was so big, and she had very full, very full nipples and breasts because she was suckling her young. So it was very sort of weirdly human-like, actually, watching her groom herself on the other side of the bank. And it was just amazing. There was not a breath of wind, golden light. There were dragonflies about. And she was just so behaving so naturally in such a wild environment. And it was just such a joy to watch. And I'll never, ever forget it. And just seeing the reaction of people. There were about five or six of us on the bank, and just seeing everybody react to this moment was just really, really special.
And there's something about those moments where the world almost seems to shrink and nothing else matters, and you're just in thrall, really, with the creature in front of you. And also what I love is when you said someone was shouting, beaver, beaver, it's kind of like that with wildlife, because the people who know what's going on, the people who've seen these things regularly, they want the people who haven't seen them to see them and engage, because just maybe in that moment of first connection, of first encounter, quite possibly you may change somebody forever. They go, oh my God, this is incredible watching this. I've seen it happen with otters. I've seen it happen with God knows how many birds. And to hear you talk about your moment with first contact with a beaver is something magical. And I think, put it like this, it's like people don't realize what we've got in this country at times. If I just take it to birds again for a moment, people go, oh my God, I saw a woodpecker. I thought they were American. Or, oh my God, I saw this incredible bird. It had a red face and yellow on its wings. And of course, it's a goldfinch. People, more often than not, are surprised at what they see. So when you say, actually, that's quite a common bird, or this is quite rare, or whatever, you've got a chance of them going, well, hold on, there might be more for me to see. It's kind of ironic when you tell these stories, because this happens all the time, and in a way they're all kind of eureka moments. That's what you're hoping for. That's what we want people to engage with nature for, so that they can go, I want to help this.
Yeah.
So with the trust, this has grown exponentially over the last year or so. How much do you think that's to do with lockdown and people are able to discover these things? And how much does one hope that this isn't a transitory phase for a lot of these people, that they become committed to the cause?
So I think the success of the beaver story, or the popularity over the last year, is massively helped by the fact it's a really charismatic mammal and really easy to talk about and really easy to celebrate. Our friends at other charities who are working with other animals, for example, have often sort of joked that they're jealous of how easy the beaver is to talk about, because there's just endless things to celebrate about it. And it's just a very cute, cuddly, very sort of quintessential mammal to look at. You know, it's been part of folklore and storytelling for hundreds of years. So that really helps us from a comms perspective in that sense, to get people excited about it. And then, of course, Springwatch has really helped in covering the Cornwall Beaver Project, which is Beaver Trust's own project down in Cornwall in Laddock, run by Chris Jones. So that's really helped us get the messages out there. But I think lockdown has had a very fascinating... It's been a fascinating experiment, really, to sort of see, okay, if we strip everything away, what have we got left and what are we drawn to? And it seems like we're drawn to nature, which is, I believe, exposing our very innate connection with the earth and with nature itself, and also demonstrates how much distraction we have accumulated over the years in our society, especially in this part of the world, which has just totally covered up the things that we should be holding closer. which is just our connection to the natural world. And so, you know, the world is moving very fast. It's very demanding. Our attention spans are really short. So all these things are hurdles to overcome in conservation comms. And I think famously nature is just seen as a little bit lame and a bit of a pastime for, you know, when you get older. You'll get into it when you get older. You know, there's too much fun to be had when you're young, and, you know, you'll get into bird watching when you hit your 50th birthday or something like that, just to be crude. But that is just, especially around my group of friends, and I've certainly had these thoughts in the past in terms of like, oh, you know, just a bit sort of sleepy and very doom and gloom in a way. But I think there's an exciting wave happening that I think has been helped by social media. And I'm a firm believer. And it goes back to what you were saying about if you can get one person to be impacted by a moment, whether it's seeing a beaver, seeing a dragonfly, seeing a goldfinch. If that one person goes away and, I don't know, adopts a small change in their life to help the natural world in a little way, or they go on to inspire one other person, you've got this very exciting domino effect that might start happening. And it's all about that lasting connection. And I think if we just get more nature out there in people's minds, in people's conversation, podcasts like these, you know, podcasts have had a massive boom over the last year. There's loads of nature podcasts out there now. And I think if we normalise nature more and just make it more of a part of our life and not isolate it into this exclusive, privileged hobby that I think it's been for too long, then I think it will just become integrated into our lives a bit more. And it has to be, you know, we can't afford, we don't have time to sort of overthink it. We just need to normalise it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Normalising is a very interesting word. It reminds me of an artist that I know, and I went to see them before lockdown, this some time ago, but she was telling me about a blackbird that would come into the house every day and sit with her. And I went, oh, right, okay. I didn't really believe it. And as we were sat down having a cup of tea, I swear to God, this blackbird walked in and just sat down by the chair, by her feet, and that was it for the next 20 minutes.
Wow.
Wasn't worried, wasn't fussed.
Wow.
And then it went out again. And she said, see, he does it every single day. And you realise that we are only moments away from these kind of connections. When animals trust you and wildlife trust you, there can be a bond between the two. And somehow we just continually smash that to pieces, or constantly through the progress of humanity. And let's not even get into that. But but yeah, I mean, with the Beaver Trust, what's incredible, in the short time that you've been there, there's been an awful lot of uptake, as you say. But also, I think it's very interesting that you ended up releasing a film called Beavers Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? And has that been received rapturously?
Yeah, so Beavers Without Borders was actually the vision of James Wallace, our chief executive, again, who, the one I mentioned, who was very forward-thinking. And he, very soon after I started, sort of said, Sophie, I've been having for years an idea about, I'd love there to be a documentary on the story of beavers, and for it to be modern, and for it to get people up to speed, really, with what the beavers are, what they do, and why their introduction has caused so much chatter and got people excited, but also a bit riled up. So then we sort of chatted a bit about what he wanted it to be. And then I said, we both knew this incredible filmmaker called Nina Constable, who's based in Cornwall and is responsible for some of the most beautiful conservation films out there at the moment, telling all sorts of stories, especially about people's connection to nature and the land, and profiling people who are doing good stuff with it. She had been following the story of the Cornwall Beaver Project since it began, so she was very familiar with the beaver story already. And so it was a no-brainer to see if she was interested in being involved. And then it sort of spiraled from there. We had the early conversations and decided that it would be good to have someone young and ideally female to front the film, because this space is famously male dominated, and conservation generally is. And so we thought it'd be good to modernise it a little bit and show that there are actually more people, diverse range of people involved in these sorts of things, and hopefully reach out to new audiences as well, and hopefully young people too. And so we started filming in July and August, and then came out in November. We did a live stream during lockdown, and the reception was immense. We didn't expect it at all. You know, we're a tiny, tiny charity with a very, very small reach, but I think it just represented how many people are interested in the beaver story. And I think the beavers are responsible for getting a lot of people at least aware of conservation and ecology and river health, more so than before. And it's gone on to win some awards and be shortlisted for various things, which is really exciting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've watched it. I loved it. I think it's wonderful because,
thank you,
just for those that don't know, the film follows you to various sites around the country where beavers have been reintroduced. And also you speak to somebody in Germany about the reintroduction. I think that was quite some time ago, 60 years ago or so, in Bavaria. It just felt as though you were trying to say, look, some people might have issues, because you do deal with the issues in the film as well. Just to explain some of it, perhaps you could say, I mean, there are people who are worried about beavers. Why are they worried about beavers?
Yeah, it's a really important thing to relay. And you're right, in the film, we really wanted to have those conversations public, and we wanted the people who have those concerns to feel listened to and to feel heard. And as I said before, you know, the land that we have in our countryside now has changed beyond recognition since beavers were last here. You know, farming has become closer and closer to the river's edge. We're farming more. We have more people. We have more roads. We have more housing. And so to have, we just don't have that much space for all of those things to exist properly and to exist healthily and harmoniously. And so lots of people are concerned about beavers felling trees and flooding farmland and ruining crops. People are also concerned about beavers and fish populations. So there's ongoing discussions with the angling community about how beavers can actually help fish populations. But there's lots of concern that beaver dams can disrupt salmon and trout migration. And there's ongoing science to really dig deep to find out what the data is there. But from what we know in other case studies in Norway and Bavaria, where beavers and fish have coexisted for much longer than they have here, that they're actually, you know, they've co-evolved and they're mutually beneficial for each other, and that the benefits massively outweigh the costs. There's always trade-offs in nature, but we need to look at the bigger picture. And we don't really have time to kind of, in terms of a climate change perspective, I feel, my opinion, we don't have time to get bogged down in the nuance. We just need to get on and do it.
You know, what you're talking about is compromise, which is the word that I find really very difficult. I've only been recording this series about rivers and the River Welland in particular for a short while, but already listening to the figures about, what is it I heard yesterday, something like 80% of rivers and streams in this country are considered non-bathable. And the term non-bathable basically means it is not safe for anyone to go in them or go near them. I find that a dramatic way of looking at it, and surely is a fact that needs to be dealt with and really sort out what the issues are. Are you suggesting that beavers can help with rivers and streams and things? And why are rivers and streams important for us?
Gosh, big question.
Oh, sorry.
I think what we often forget is that rivers are basically the veins of our country. And everything that goes into the river ends up in the sea. And the water cycle is something that we learn. Well, it's one of the first things that we learn at school. But we seem to have forgotten how everything's connected, and it's often always connected by water. Water is like the transport highway of everything. So as soon as we start to spread fertilizers and pesticides all over the countryside for our crops, we forget that often these end up in the watercourses and end up in the sea. And if the sea and the rivers are unhealthy, that destabilizes the climate, as we're seeing. And so I think it's a much bigger problem than I think we care to realize and care to admit. It's much easier to kind of brush it off and, oh, I'll deal with it later, let's deal with it later. And we might not live to see the true catastrophes that will unfold as a result of what we've done to the land, but we shouldn't think like that. in terms of beavers, you know, there's so much science to suggest and to prove how beaver dams can basically act like massive filters for the river, and that the water beyond a beaver dam, once it's passed through, is of better quality than the water that came into it. And so, you know, for rivers that do have these pesticides and insecticides and pollutants in there, if there are beaver dams down a network of a catchment, the water, as a result, at the mouth before it enters the sea, will be of better quality. There's just no two ways about it. That's what the science says. And so if the water is of good quality, then insects and birds and other mammals who share the river space are going to do better. They're going to breed better. They're going to have better food for foraging. They're going to have a better life. And so it's all just this cycle of ecology. As I said before, beavers are an amazing teacher of ecology. And I think that we forget how connected everything is. And I wish that they taught us ecology at school and used beavers as an example. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do at the Trust, is to get beavers into the curriculum, because kids love them. And everyone who you speak to about beavers, on the whole, absolutely is just enthralled by them. So we need to use that tool as an education kind of lever to help sort things out. And by no means beavers are a silver bullet, definitely not. They're just part of a solution to help sort out the mess that is our environment. They're an ally, and we need to view them as such. Yes, they've got their problems. They can be a pain in the arse, but nothing is without its problems. And we need to stop trying to focus on the problems and focus on finding a solution-based approach fast. Else we're just going to keep going round and round in circles.
Yeah, I think several things come out of that. But, you know, I think the word when you said we might find out later the problems and we might not be around for it. Well, I think we're kind of close to later, almost, so that it's become now. And I think that's a huge issue. There was also something that there's a line in the film which really stuck with me. And I think it's a magnificent line. And I'd just like to use this as the last word about beavers. Derek Gow in the film said, beavers create life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, beavers create life. It just sounds like a T-shirt. It sounds like a slogan. It sounds like everything. Yeah. And it's a rock star, a beaver.
He's amazing at his sound bites, is Derek.
But that is true, though, isn't it? Beavers do create life.
Yeah, they do. They just by, and I think an important point is that I think people like to go a little bit too far and feel that beavers are very altruistic and they're doing it for the good of the planet and the good of humanity, and aren't they lovely? But they are just rodents at the end of the day. They're not very smart, but this is just their innate adaptation. Their instinct is to build, their instinct is to cultivate and to work the environment in the way that the evolution has told them to, in a way. And by doing so, they create habitat, they create life. You know, wherever there is water, the wildlife will come. And beavers create water, and they create a healthy, thriving, gloriously messy environment. And that's what the world needs to be. That's what the world used to look like. But we have just got too used to it being neat and marginalised and disconnected and working for us. But in order for us to work better, we need to let wildlife do its thing.
No, I think that's spot on. And I would say that every creature has a purpose. There is, I can't think of many pointless creatures other than possibly humans. You know, it's frustrating. Oh.
Plot twist.
Yeah. A bit of a throwaway line just to finish it all off with. I think that's well said. And anyone who wants to know more about the Beaver Trust should go to beavertrust.org, I believe, is your web address.
That's the one. Yeah, thank you.
We should certainly move on to now the current work you're doing, as well as the Beaver Trust, is you've got a book coming out, haven't you, called Forget Me Not. What are you imploring us to remember with that title, and when is it coming out?
So I'm imploring you to remember, I guess, the wildlife and the landscapes that we're so lucky to have here in the British Isles before it might be too late. So it's not about the flower at all. It's more of a plea to just look again at nature and to not ignore it, because we might wish that we that we didn't one day, and that would be a real shame. And it's out on the 9th of June, so that's quite exciting.
Okay, so what's the format of the book? What happens in it? You don't need to give away the ending or too much about it, but what are you looking
at? Well, I don't know the ending yet.
We never know the ending until it's finished.
We never know the ending. It's a big question. So the format is, it's a non-fiction narrative. It documents 10 trips that I make around the UK, or around the British Isles, really, over the last year. So I've got one more trip actually to do. I've just come back from one, and I've got one more to do, and then that's it. And 10 trips to see 10 species and habitats that I believe are overlooked but important, and importantly, habitats and species that are at risk of human impacts on the land or climate change. And it kind of is a light-hearted but hopefully meaningful, I guess, expose of these animals and their life histories, and also how are they going to fare in the world today, and what does the future look like for them if we carry on business as usual. And the sort of slight twist and fun bit is that all the travel to these places, and I go from Cornwall to Orkney, all over England, and then to Scotland a couple of times again, and Wales, and all of the travel is low carbon, because I sort of thought, well, it would be a bit hypocritical of me to sort of expose all of our mistakes and our carbon heavy lifestyles if I just used a private vehicle and flew to all these places or drove my car. So there's a travel narrative there which hopefully encourages us to just be a little bit aware and try and do what we can to minimise our carbon footprint. And then also it's more about the journey to see these creatures as opposed to actually just ticking it off the list, which is what I think people think, that naturalists just go to, you know, tick birds off and tick animals off and all, look, I've got more than you. But actually it's more about the thrill of the chase and the journey and having fun along the way. And it was a chance for me to get out on my bike and get in the kayak and paddleboard and things like that, and go on some nice hikes to try and make the most of my local doorstep, but then also go further afield and show that it can be done in a lower carbon way if we want it to. But there's also some challenges there too.
Well, there's always challenges, especially in road trips. I've spent a lifetime, any project I do involves a road trip usually, and I totally get what you're saying. It's the process, it's the journey. They are the fundamental parts of most projects for me, and by the sounds of it, that seems essential to you. So can you give us an example of perhaps one species you might go and see, and why should we care?
Yeah, sure. So the first species that I went to see was the marsh fritillary butterfly on Bodmin Moor. So that was a short train journey and then a bike ride up onto the moors there last June. And the marsh fritillary butterfly is, first of all, it's one of the most beautiful butterflies that we've got here in Britain. It's absolutely amazing. It's like a little stained glass window on the heathland. But it's one of the rarest, and it's been absolutely annihilated by the farming practices that we've had down here in terms of overgrazing. And its larval food plant is devil's bit scabious, which in itself is a beautiful little plant that is a real integral part of our moorlands and our heathlands. I'd never seen this butterfly before, so it was, and lots of these species I'd never seen in the wild before, so it's very much a, hopefully it comes across as I'm learning along with the reader along the way. I'm not a naturalist. I hardly know what I'm looking at most of the time. I'm not very good at species ID, but it's more that just the joy of just going out and just trying to find a butterfly, and then maybe not seeing it. I'll leave that up to everyone to find out. But getting caught in a rainstorm and all these sorts of things. But I think especially there's a few insects in there in terms of in the other chapters as well. And I thought I wanted to use a butterfly to open the book because I think that it's one of the few animals that really captivates so many people throughout their lives. You know, when you're little, you see a butterfly and you just think it's the most amazing thing, and their life cycle just is captivating in terms of, you know, the hungry caterpillar as a storybook has just enchanted so many generations of people in terms of how can a tiny caterpillar suddenly turn into this beautiful butterfly and then live a very short life on the heathland. And it just seems such a shame to think, gosh, what delicate, beautiful creature that's actually so important and such an indicator of a healthy landscape. You know, if you've got these marsh fritillary butterflies, you can be pretty sure that landscape is doing okay. But butterflies are often the first red flags in an environment where if the butterflies start to fail, that's indicative of a much bigger problem. That's a symptom of something that is not right and that we need to investigate why. So yeah, that's the first one.
But, don't give any more away. Don't give any more away. And it's very interesting that you talk about indicators. I spent yesterday going through the River Wardenship on the River Welland, with people kicking up the grit and everything on the floor to find what species were in the water, to indicate the problems, to indicate nitrates, phosphates, all these things that happen within the water. And somebody told me that an eel was a great indicator of the health of rivers and things. And you realise that the whole idea of sending a canary down a coal mine is based on the canary would be the first indicator of problems for the miners. And so we've been informed by nature and wildlife all of our lives. And somehow we're letting it go in such a strange way. It's like just letting go and releasing all this information and all this relationship that we've had for centuries. And I find it quite depressing. But at the same time, I find it inspiring when I talk to someone like you that is out there doing this, and that you've had a fight just to get to here, you know, because you want to do this. So I do think that people like you need to be supported and need to be celebrated, really, what everyone is trying to do in the world, especially the younger generation now, because without you, I think the world is screwed. I think the older generations have got away with it for far too long and have let things slide, all in the sake of progress and all in the sake of money. And we need to find a way to turn that tide. So all I can say is we're kind of out of time now. I could carry this on for hours, quite honestly. It's engaging and it's thoughtful and it's thought-provoking. What can I say? Even with the farm traffic outside your window, I think we've had the most...
Sorry.
Don't worry. Honestly, don't worry. I'm just letting people know that's what you heard. It's a world going on out there. We can't stop it just
indeed.
To chat about nature and wildlife and all those important things. It's been a fantastic time chatting to you. I've really appreciated you taking the time to talk to us. There is no doubt you are a conservationist. All I can say is please check out Sophie's work at beavertrust.org, and your book comes out with Bloomsbury publishing it. That is called Forget Me Not. I'll never forget the title. Sophie, thank you ever so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Conservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about conservation and conservation conversations at conservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at conservation. Conservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.